Disc 6.
In 1948, President Truman ran against the Do Nothing 80th Congress. How deep a chord he hit when on his come-from-behind cross-country whistle-stop tour he said it was run by a bunch of old mossbacks still living back in the 1890s was demonstrated by the election results, and by the roars of approval when he told audiences, "After a new Congress is chosen, maybe we'll get one that will work in the interests of the people and not the interests of the men who have all the money." When, before the election, in a political masterstroke, he called Congress into special session, demanding that it pass some of the legislation he had advocated, and that the Republican platform had advocated too, GOP National Campaign Manager Herbert Brownell told congressional Republicans that it might be a good idea to make at least a gesture at passing some of that legislation, particularly some relating to civil rights, since the black vote was becoming an important factor in presidential elections. But when Truman entered the House to deliver his speech opening the special session, some senators and representatives did not even rise from their seats. "No, we're not going to give that fellow anything," Senator Taft said. What did the Senate care about public opinion? Its opinion about majority rule had boiled over repeatedly during the Truman administration, an opinion held not only by Senate demagogues like Bilbo, who had taken the floor to say that a mob is a majority, without the filibuster the minority would be at the mercy of the majority, but by Senate grandees like Tidings, who asked on the Senate floor whether democracy was not predicated on the rule of majority, replied, shouting in anger, "The rule of the majority! The rule of votes! Majority to Hades! The rule of the majority! The rule that has brought more bloodshed and turmoil and cruelty on this earth than any other thing I know of." Liberals, and most infuriatingly, that liberal Washington press corps, might criticize the filibuster, but the Southern senators worshipped it. It was their defense against that despised majority. Any threat to the filibuster they regarded as a threat to the rights of man. To a request to impose cloture, the stately Walter George solemnly intoned, "We are called upon to go Nazi." "It was cloture that crucified Christ on the cross," Tidings cried. When emotions rose, the Southern senators couldn't even be bothered to conceal the fact that it was not niggers alone whom they despised. Mississippi's Bilbo addressed a letter to a New York woman of Italian descent, "Dear Dago." The Magnolia State's other senator, James O. Eastland, who would some years later stare coldly down a committee table at Senator Jacob Javits of New York, a Jew, and say, "I don't like you or your kind," now said that if the FEPC bill was constitutional, 10,000 Jewish dry goods merchants represented discrimination against the Anglo-Saxon branch of the white race, and Congress should therefore limit the number of Jews in interstate business. It wasn't only Italians and Jews whom the Southerners wanted kept in their places. While Jim Dombrowski of the Southern Conference for Human Welfare was testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Eastland repeatedly sneered at his typically old Southern name. And of course there were always the Native Americans. Defending American businessmen who did not want to employ them, Senator Bankhead explained that there is something peculiar about an Indian which causes the white American not to want to be too closely associated with him. This is the spectacle presented by the United States in the wake of a war against fascism and racism, I.F. Stone wrote caustically in The Nation in 1948. A majority of the American people might endorse Truman's proposals, not merely on civil rights but on a dozen other issues, and in towns and cities across the United States, audiences might cheer the president's assault on the Capitol Hill do-nothings. The Senate didn't care. To many senators, the New Deal was nothing more or less than socialism, and in opposing it, they were simply doing their duty. The majority might call for change, social change, economic change. These senators knew what a majority was. The majority was the mob. They had been elected to protect America against the mob. Against long odds, a president had just swept all before him. What was a president to them, to these senators who said, "We were here before he came, and we'll be here after he's gone"? And of course the Senate, particularly these Southern senators who dominated it, didn't have to care. The 6-year terms and the staggering of those terms decreed by the Founding Fathers had armored the Senate as a whole against public opinion in the nation as a whole. The majority will of the United States could reach the Senate of the United States only in very diluted form. The Senate, as a Senate, could indeed never be repudiated. And by decreeing that in the Senate each state would have the same two votes regardless of population, the fathers had further ensured that within the Senate, population wouldn't matter, that the majority wouldn't matter. The right of unlimited debate, a logical outgrowth of the founders' insistence on protecting minority rights, had bolted around the small states yet another layer of armor against the majority will. Nor could national public opinion touch an individual senator. Each senator was answerable only to the will of the majority of voters in his own state. And, of course, the stands the Southern senators were taking did not hurt, but help them with those voters. And thanks to the seniority rule, once these senators were reelected, the only thing that mattered was that they had been reelected. Their inexorable progress to the committee chairmanships would continue. The Senate decided who would hold its posts of power, and the Senate decided alone. The 1948 elections proved the point. Infuriated by the liberalism of their party's president and their party's platform, which actually included a fairly strong civil rights plank, a states' rights party was formed, with its own presidential candidate, Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, who denounced the FEPC as communistic, Truman's proposed integration of the armed services as un-American, and said, "There's not enough troops in the army to force the Southern people to admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our churches." But despite all the furor engendered by the new party, it carried a mere four states. Not only had President Truman won, he had won by turning the election into a referendum on Congress. In terms of majority rule, the South had been thoroughly repudiated. Although Truman had won, however, the Southern senators hadn't lost. A liberal tide had washed over the rest of the country, as it had washed over the country in 1904 and 1912 and 1936. But while it had swept a liberal majority into the Senate, not a single Southerner standing for re-election had been defeated. The majority party in both houses of Congress would be Democratic, not Republican. But in both House and Senate, the committee chairmanships would again be held by Southerners. If anything, Southern power on Capitol Hill would be stronger, not weaker. The attribute which in the Senate meant power was seniority, and seniority was inexorable and cumulative. The senators who would return in January would return with more, not less, of that asset. The South's point of view might have been repudiated. Its position of entrenched minority in the Senate was untouched. Although Truman had won on the basis of his Fair Deal program, that program's fate would still be controlled by anti-Fair Deal Southerners. And in the unlikely event that Truman's proposals somehow emerged from committee, there was still the filibuster in the Senate. What was the legislation that had been defeated in the Senate in 1948? Legislation for civil rights, for aid to education, for aid to housing, for a fairer minimum wage, for better health care. An entire agenda of social justice, to a considerable extent endorsed by the nation, had been blocked in the Senate. Similar legislation had been blocked in the Senate for a decade and more. There was no reason, despite Truman's victory, to think it would pass now. The Senate's golden age had ended almost a century before. During the ensuing decades, the institution had been subtly altered, decade by decade, into something significantly different from the body that had been envisioned by the Founding Fathers. They had wanted it to be independent, a place of wisdom and deliberation armored against outside forces. But the rise inside the Senate itself of forces they had not sufficiently foreseen, the rise of parties and party caucuses and of party discipline, the transformation of America's infant industries into gigantic economic entities which had representatives sitting in the Senate itself, had undermined the Senate's independence from within, and the impact of these new forces on the Senate had been heightened because the armor against outside forces remained in place. Still protected against the people and the president, both of which wanted social progress, the Senate was unprotected against internal forces that opposed social progress, and that were indeed making it much less a place of wisdom and deliberation. Other internal developments, most importantly seniority and the filibuster, had further distorted the founders' dream. They had envisioned the Senate as the moderating force in government, as the cooler of the popular will. Cool had become cold, had become ice, ice in which, for decades, with only a few brief exceptions, the popular desire for social change had become frozen. Designed as the deliberative power, the Senate had become instead the negative power, the selfish power. The necessary fence against executive and popular tyranny had been transformed, by party rule and by the seniority rule, into something thicker and higher, into an impenetrable wall against the democratic impulses it had originally been supposed only to refine and filter, into a dam against which waves of social reform, attempts to ameliorate the human condition, dashed themselves in vain. Except for brief moments, the beginning of Wilson's presidency, for example, and the 100 days of Roosevelt's, when the floodgates in the dam suddenly swung wide and the tides swept through, cleansing the great republic, the founder's armor had resisted every attempt by others to force them open. The Senate had been designed as the firm body. It had become too firm to allow the reforms the republic needed. Never had the dam been more firm than during the last decade, the decade since the conservative coalition had learned its strength. During that decade, despite the mandate of 3 presidential elections, it had stood across and blocked the rising demand for social justice, had stood so solidly that it seemed too strong ever to be breached. In January 1949, when Lyndon Johnson arrived in it, it was still standing. Part 2. Learning. Chapter 4. A Hard Path. Newly elected senators of the United States are sworn in groups of 4. They stand in the rear of the high-ceilinged Senate chamber, their sponsors, generally their state's senior senator, at their side. And when each new senator's turn comes, his sponsor takes his arm and escorts him ceremoniously down the broad, shallow steps of the center aisle, between the rows of mahogany desks at which Webster sat, and Clay and Calhoun, and Borah and Norris and the La Follettes, father and son, down to the well where, on the dais above it, the Senate's president is waiting, framed by marble columns. When, on January 3, 1949, the Secretary of the Senate called Lyndon Johnson's name, old Tom Connolly, a hero in Texas since Johnson had been a boy, took his arm in a firm grip, and they walked together down to the dais where the legendary Arthur Vandenberg was standing, stiffly erect, right hand already raised for the oath. "Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States?" Vandenberg asked. And Lyndon Johnson said, "I do." He had traveled a hard path to get to the Senate, from a hard place, the remote, barren Texas hill country, a land of loneliness and poverty. And for the young Lyndon Johnson, born on August 27, 1908, son of failed and ridiculed parents, a land of humiliation and fear, even the fear of having his home taken away by the bank. For a while, he had come along that path fast, remarkably fast. At 21, while still an undergraduate at a little teacher's college known as a poor boys' school, he was running 2 campaigns, one for a state legislator, the other for a candidate for lieutenant governor, in a block of hill country counties, and politicians all over Texas began hearing about this wonder kid who knew more about politics than anyone else in the area. By the time he was 23, a congressman's aide who had only recently arrived in Washington with a cardboard suitcase and no clothes warm enough for a northern winter, and who for months didn't have enough money to buy any, he was the boss of the Little Congress, a club of congressional aides that he had made influential on Capitol Hill. By 26, he had been appointed the National Youth Administration's director for the state of Texas, thereby becoming perhaps the youngest person the New Deal ever put in charge of a statewide program. At 28, he was elected to Congress after a campaign against 7 better-known opponents. Within 4 years, using money from Texas contractors and oilmen, he injected new energy into a stagnant Democratic congressional campaign committee, gained influence over other congressmen, and a toehold on national power. And when, in April 1941, one of his state's senators died, and a special election was called to fill the vacancy, Franklin Roosevelt allowed him to announce his candidacy from the White House steps. And the belief in Washington was that Lyndon Johnson, still only 32 years old, would become America's youngest senator. During that campaign, polls showed him pulling steadily away from his principal opponent, Texas Governor W. Lee "Pappy" O'Daniel, and that belief seemed justified. And then, in an instant, with one slip, he was stopped. He hadn't made many slips. He was always telling his aides, "If you do everything, you'll win." And during his decade-long ascent of the political ladder, he had done everything. Had worked so hard that a tough Texas political boss said, "I never thought it was possible for anyone to work that hard." Had worked with a feverish, almost frantic intensity that journalists would describe as energy, when it was really desperation and fear, the fear of a man fleeing from something terrible. Throughout all that decade, moreover, he had planned and intrigued, trying to think of everything, unceasingly careful and wary. But at the very end of that 1941 race, on Election Day itself, he had relaxed. In his euphoria over apparent victory, he violated an old adage of Texas politics by reporting too early in the day the vote totals from the corrupt counties he controlled, thereby letting O'Daniel know how many votes were needed from the corrupt counties he controlled, and giving him the opening necessary to win. And with that defeat, the years of triumph ended, to be followed by very different years. He had expected that another chance at a Senate seat would come almost immediately, with the election in 1942 for the full term, but the Second World War deprived him of that chance, and he was not to get another for 7 years. Those years, 1941 to 1948, were Lyndon Johnson's years in the wilderness. He had been lured always by the gleam from a single goal. As a youth, working on a road gang with the reins of a mule-drawn Fresno scoop shovel looped around his back, so that he was in effect in harness with the mules, his hands blistered and bleeding from the Fresno's handles, his face seared in summer by the fierce hill country sun and in winter by the fierce hill country wind, the tall, skinny, awkward youth had told his fellow workers, "I'm going to be President of the United States one day." Once he was on the path he had mapped out to that goal, mapped out with a sophistication and pragmatism striking in one so young, he almost never spoke of it, but despite his silence, those who knew him best understood his ambition. James H. Rowe, Jr., who spent more time with Johnson than any of the other rising young New Dealers, says, in words echoed by other members of their Washington circle, "From the day he got here, he wanted to be president." Johnson was later to tell journalists that his two daughters had been given the same initials as he because this way we can use the same luggage. But during his House years he would be more frank with his aide Horace Busby, telling Busby to refer to him in press releases as LBJ. The young congressman said, "FDR, LBJ, FDR, LBJ, do you get it? What I want is for them to start thinking of me in terms of initials." It was only presidents whom headline writers and the American public referred to by their initials. He was just so determined that someday he would be known as LBJ, Busby says. And sometimes, as if he could not endure the frustration of his hopes, what he really wanted burst out of him, as it did one evening when he was alone with his old friend Welly Hopkins. "By God, I'll be president someday!" So long as the path to that goal lay open before him, nothing could make him turn off it. It ran only through Washington. National power, not state power, was the key. He refused to run for the governorship of Texas. To aides who assured him he would win the governorship, he explained that he didn't want to, that that job could never be more than a detour on his route, a detour that might turn into a dead end. So long as the path lay open, not even the chance for financial security could turn him from it. Tormented during his pre-war House years by his lack of money, continually complaining that he had nothing, not $1,000 in the bank, he said. He spoke constantly of ending up like his father, who had died penniless, and pleaded with the Texas tycoons who had bankrolled his career to bankroll him, to put him in the way of making a little money. But when, in 1940, they offered him a lot of money, a partnership in an oil company offered on terms that made it virtually a gift, worth perhaps $750,000, he turned the offer down because, he explained, "I can't be an oil man. If the public knew he had oil interests, it would kill me politically." In discussing his political ambitions, Johnson had previously spoken to these men only of the House and Senate. He had said over and over that, as one of them recalls, he wanted to remain in Congress until a Senate seat opened up and then run for that seat, that the Senate was his ultimate goal in politics, and had never mentioned any other office. But Johnson's congressional district was safe. Being an oil man couldn't hurt him there, and it certainly couldn't hurt him if he ran for the Senate in oil-dominated Texas. Then these supporters realized that there was another office for which, indeed, a candidate would be killed by being an oil man, and they realized at last what Lyndon Johnson really wanted, and how much he wanted it. But now, after 1941, the path was closed. For the next 7 years, Lyndon Johnson remained stuck in the House of Representatives. Men and women who knew him in Washington describe him in words that echo words used to describe him by men and women who knew him in Johnson City, words which, in fact, he had in his youth used about himself. He had to be somebody, they would say, just had to. Could not stand, in the words of one of them, to be one of a crowd. Just could not stand it. But in the House, with its 435 members who jammed its cloakrooms and jostled in the aisles of its chamber, its 435 members of whom only a few handfuls, members who had been there for decades, had significant authority, he couldn't, as a junior congressman, be anything but one of a crowd. His lack of interest in the body's general legislative work had always been noticeable, and it remained so, particularly after a 1943 fiasco in which he tried to push himself into national prominence by introducing a bill that would have usurped the jurisdiction of a committee of which he was not a member. During the more than 11 years that Lyndon Johnson would eventually serve in the House, he would introduce only 4 bills that would have had an effect beyond the borders of his own congressional district. In fact, he introduced only 3 intra-district bills, a total in 11 years of only 7 bills, less than the number introduced by any of the 20 other representatives who entered Congress in the same year he did. Only 2 of his bills, 2 minor measures that affected only his own district, were enacted into law. He made almost as few formal speeches as laws, and seldom participated in informal discussions and debates, the daily give and take of legislative business. Entire years passed in which he did not rise even once to make a point of order, or any other point, to ask or answer a question, to support or attack a bill under discussion, to participate, by so much as a single word, in an entire year's worth of floor proceedings. Although Johnson adherents would contend in later years that he was active in the House in other ways, by quietly lobbying his colleagues in the cloakrooms on behalf of liberal causes, for instance, this picture could hardly be contradicted more strongly by the men who knew, the men he had supposedly lobbied. As one of his fellow congressmen says, he just simply was not especially interested in general legislation that came to the floor. Some of us were on the floor all the time, fighting for liberal causes, but he stayed away from the floor, and while he was there, he was very, very silent. Liberal colleagues believed him to be liberal at heart. Conservative colleagues believed him to be conservative. Says one extremely conservative Republican congressman, "Politically, if we disagreed, it wasn't apparent to me, not at all." In fact, no one really knew his heart because he seldom fought for an issue or even expressed a definite opinion about it. His insistence on being the center of attention, of dominating any room in which he found himself, had never slackened. At Washington dinner parties, he wanted to do the talking, and if someone else held the floor for any length of time, he would go to sleep at the table, or pretend to, his eyes closing, his head nodding forward. When he woke up, friends say, he woke up talking, and if he was still not allowed to hold the floor, his eyes would close again. But in Washington, people's willingness to listen is a coefficient of the power of the person talking. Lyndon Johnson didn't have much power, and as it became more and more apparent that he wasn't going to have much, at least in any foreseeable future, it became harder for him to hold the stage. And on Capitol Hill, Johnson was constantly trying to domineer over his fellow congressmen, to lecture them on politics in a dogmatic, overbearing tone, to act as if they owed him favors, and these efforts were arousing more and more resentment. Frequently, when he indulged in a characteristic habit of putting one arm around a colleague's shoulders and grasping the colleague's lapel with his other hand, the colleague would draw back from the hand. At least once, a colleague angrily knocked it away. All too frequently, colleagues with whom he had served for years would come into the House dining room and pointedly ignore him as they walked past his table. Lyndon Johnson hated his years in the House in which, this man who could not stand being only one of a crowd, He was only one of the hundreds of congressmen who had no power or ability to accomplish anything, whose days were punctuated with reminders of his lack of status. He started avoiding the Democratic cloakroom and the floor. He couldn't work up the enthusiasm anymore, a colleague says. The 7 years from 1941 to 1948 were years of hopelessness and despair. 7 years in what was, for Lyndon Johnson, the bleakest possible wilderness, a life without any political power that he considered meaningful. Deepening the despair was another consideration, one that sometimes seemed to prey upon Lyndon Johnson's mind more than any other. Power in the House of Representatives could come only through seniority, through waiting, waiting for many years. And Lyndon Johnson was convinced that he didn't have many years. Throughout his boyhood, he had heard relatives repeating a piece of family lore, that all Johnson men had weak hearts and died young. Then, while he was still in college and his father was barely 50 years old, his father's heart had begun to fail. Sam Ely Johnson died, after years of heart trouble, in 1937, 12 days after his 60th birthday. One of Sam's two younger brothers, Lyndon's uncles, died of a massive heart attack in 1939 at the age of 57. The other suffered one heart attack in 1946 at the age of 65, and a second in 1947, and was to live his last years as a near invalid. Lyndon was always deeply conscious of his marked physical resemblance to his tall, gawky, big-eared, big-nosed father. His shoulder-hugging and lapel-grasping was an inherited mannerism. Wright Patman, who served in Congress with Lyndon Johnson and in the Texas legislature with his father, says, "Lyndon clutched you like his daddy did when he talked to you. They looked alike, they walked the same, had the same nervous mannerisms. He was so much like his father that it was humorous to watch." Lyndon was convinced, to what one of his secretaries calls the point of obsession, that he had inherited the family legacy. "I'm not going to live to be but 60," he would say. "My daddy died at 60. My uncle..." Now, as he grew older, whenever it was suggested that he might make his career in the House of Representatives, he would reply in a low voice, "Too slow, too slow." The long, slow path to power in the House might be the only one open to him, but he felt it was not a path feasible for him to follow. Constant as was his ultimate ambition, during those 7 years there sometimes seemed no possibility of its realization, and without that possibility, or at least the chance for some form of increased power, the complexity of Lyndon Johnson's motivations became clear. Despite repeated campaign promises to serve in the trenches if war came, for months after Pearl Harbor he maneuvered to stay out of any combat zone, and finally, forced into one, flew on a single bombing mission as an observer and then hurried back to Washington. There he tried to obtain high civilian rank. He campaigned vigorously for an appointment as Secretary of the Navy, which would have made him one of the youngest cabinet officers in history. But when he didn't get the job, his interest in the war faded, so markedly that to an aide it was obvious that if he couldn't have real authority in it, he regarded it as an interference with his agenda. He attempted to dissuade his young assistants from enlisting, or if they were drafted, often tried to have their draft notices rescinded so that they could continue serving him rather than their country. During his pre-war years as a congressman, he had, in a monumental feat of ingenuity and resolve, brought electricity to his isolated district, in a single stroke bringing the farmers and ranchers of the hill country into the 20th century. And he had maximized the effect within it of so many New Deal programs that he had been called the best congressman for a district there ever was. During these next 7 years, with his programs in place and being carried forward by an efficient staff, his interest in his district steadily waned. In a state which routinely re-elected incumbent congressmen, there was no realistic chance he would lose his seat, but he was increasingly less involved with his job. He had been interested, deeply involved, in working for his constituents so long as that work held out the prospect, the imminent prospect, of leading to something more. But so dramatically did his interest wane the moment it appeared that his work for his district might have to be an end in itself, that helping people seemed to mean as little to him as helping the war effort. Without the prospect of new, greater power, the power he possessed was meaningless to him. So long as the path to power lay open before him, he had been willing to defer, even to sacrifice, his need for financial security. Now, with that path closed, perhaps forever, the deferring was over. During the 7 years following his defeat in the 1941 Texas senatorial election, Lyndon Johnson grabbed for money as greedily as he had grabbed for power, using his political influence to do so, and using it so successfully that by 1948 he was boasting that instead of $1,000 he had $1 million, a small fortune at that time. In 1948 he decided to take one last desperate gamble, entering a race for the Senate, although he would be running against Coke Robert Stevenson, the only man in the state's history to hold all three of its top governmental posts, Speaker, Lieutenant Governor, Governor, and a public figure so beloved in Texas that in the last Democratic primary he had entered, the crucial election in a one-party state, he had carried every one of the state's 254 counties, the only candidate for governor or senator who had ever done so. The cowboy governor, as he was known, was considered invincible. The stakes of the gamble were all the higher because under Texas law, Johnson could not run for the Senate without relinquishing his House seat and his 11 years of seniority. One of Johnson's key advisers was not exaggerating when he says of the 1948 race, "That was it, all or nothing." Johnson himself recoiled from the risk. "At first," he was to say, "I just could not bear the thought of losing everything." But he took the gamble because the imperatives of his character gave him no choice. Another congressman might have decided not to take such a risk because losing would mean he might have to leave Washington with its excitement and glamour. But for Lyndon Johnson, not excitement or glamour, but power was the basic need. To stay on in Washington without it was intolerable to him. If he lost, he said, he would leave politics forever and go into business. He may have been born to politics, may have been a master of the political game, but without power, he didn't want to remain in it. Every stage of Lyndon Johnson's career had been marked not only by pragmatism, but by what is, in a democracy in which power is conferred by elections, the ultimate pragmatism, the stealing of elections. Even at little Southwest Texas State Teachers College in San Marcos, where campus politics had previously been little more than a joke and elections the most casual of affairs, Johnson stole elections. On Capitol Hill, the pattern was repeated. Lyndon Johnson cheated not only in the election in which he won the presidency of the little Congress, but in succeeding elections in which his allies won. Everyone said it. In that last election, that damn Lyndon Johnson stole some votes again. And on the one occasion on which a little Congress ballot box was actually opened, the accusations proved to be true. He had stolen thousands of votes in his first campaign for the Senate. When that number proved insufficient, because, thanks to his mistake, his opponent was able to steal even more, his reaction was to try to steal still more, by trying to persuade the corrupt border county dictator George Parr to go further than Parr had ever gone before. But even the notorious Parr would not go to the lengths that Johnson wanted. "Lyndon, I've been to the federal penitentiary, and I'm not going back for you," he said. At every stage of Johnson's political career, he had stretched the rules of the game to their breaking point, and then had broken them, pushing deeper into the ethical and legal no-man's land beyond them than others were willing to go. In this 1948 campaign, in this all-or-nothing campaign, his last chance, the pattern became even clearer. He stole not thousands, but tens of thousands of votes, and when they were insufficient to defeat Stevenson, asked about the attempt made decades later to portray Stevenson aides as also stealing votes, Edward A. Clark, the longtime secret boss of Texas, would laugh. They didn't know how, and Governor Stevenson didn't know how. He stole still more. And in this later theft, which culminated in the finding of the decisive votes, supposedly cast by 202 voters who voted in alphabetical order, 6 days after the polls closed, he went further than anyone had gone before, violating even the most notably loose boundaries of Texas politics. Even in terms of a most elastic political morality, the political morality of 1940s Texas, his methods were immoral. An investigation into the theft was halted, largely through the legal ingenuity of Johnson's brilliant attorney, Abe Fortas, At the very moment at which testimony was coming to a climax, before a federal master in chancery appointed by a United States District Court judge. Asked later what his report would have concluded had the proceeding been allowed to continue, this official said flatly, "I think Lyndon was put in the United States Senate with a stolen election." No matter how he was put there, however, he was there. "Do you solemnly swear?" Vandenberg asked. And when Lyndon Johnson replied, "I do," his years in the wilderness were over. Chapter 5. The Path Ahead. At first glance, the place he had worked so hard to reach seemed peculiarly unsuited to him, unsuited both to his nature and to his ambition. Austere, restrained, dignified, courtly, refined, these were not the adjectives that, in January 1949, sprang first to mind in describing Lyndon Johnson. Big as he was, he seemed even bigger. In part, the reasons were physical. Everything about him was outsized, dramatic. His arms were long, even for a man of his height, and his hands, those huge mottled hands, were big even for those arms. And then there was his great head, with the big jutting nose, the big jutting jaw, those immense ears, the powerful shape of the massive skull emphasized because his thinning hair was slicked down flat against it with stay-comb hair tonic. And most of all, there were his eyes, under long, heavy black eyebrows. People in the Texas Hill Country believed that the key to understanding Lyndon Johnson was to remember that he was a descendant of a clan, legendary in the Hill Country, named Bunton. Generations of Bunton men had possessed not only great ambition and a commanding presence that enabled them to realize it. They were elected to public office, to the Congress of Texas when it was an independent republic, to the Texas legislature after it became a state, in their 20s, as Lyndon Johnson had been elected to public office in his 20s. But they were also tall like Lyndon, always over 6 feet, and had features strikingly similar to his, including the big ears, jaw, and nose, the heavy black eyebrows, and in particular what the Hill Country called the Bunton eye. Generations of Buntons had eyes so dark a brown that they seemed black, so bright that they glittered, so piercing that their glare was memorably intimidating. "If you talk to a Bunton," said Lyndon's cousin Ava Johnson Cox, "you never had to wonder if the answer was yes or no. Those eyes told you. Those eyes talked. They spit fire." From the time he was a baby, all through his youth and young manhood, Lyndon Johnson, the Hill Country agreed, had the Bunton eye. And in Washington, where no one had ever heard of the Buntons, people were also struck by Lyndon Johnson's eyes. Years later, a British journalist would leave his first audience with the president to write, "Afterward, you chiefly remember the eyes, steady and unrelenting under half-lowered lids." The journalist would also write that those eyes showed an exceptional wariness, and he was correct about that, as correct as he would have been had he been writing in 1949. Johnson's assistants, who often said among themselves that their boss never trusted anyone, were joking that January that he didn't even trust Santa Claus. On the day before Christmas 1948, walking with several of them along a Washington street, he had come across a costumed Santa Claus, a friendly-faced elderly man, soliciting contributions for the Salvation Army. Johnson had asked the man if he could hire him to entertain the children at a Christmas party in his home that evening, and when the man agreed, had handed him $2 $20 bills as a down payment. As he was walking away, however, he whirled around, came back, and demanded the bills. When the Santa Claus returned them, he tore them in half and gave one half back to the man. "Here," he said, "you get the other half if you show up." Johnson's size was also emphasized by his awkwardness, by his long, lunging strides, by the vigorous, sweeping gestures of his arms to make a point. When he burst through a door, with those long strides and that commanding air, he just filled up a room, as one acquaintance put it. His clothes were dramatic, too. Although he owned blue suits, most of them didn't look like those worn by other senators. So rich and shimmering was their fabric that friends joked about Lyndon's silver suits. And even with his conservative blue suit, and even when he was wearing it with a starched white shirt, he often didn't wear one of his many understated Countess Mara neckties, but rather one of the style known in Texas as a Fat Max tie. short, very wide, and garishly hand-painted, some with placidly grazing horses, some with bucking broncos, one favorite had shapely cowgirls astride, some with oil-field derricks. Gold glinted from his wrists. The cuffs of his shirts were fastened by notably large solid gold cufflinks in the shape of Texas, with a diamond in the center to show the location of Austin. His gold watch was so heavy that when he went to a doctor he was careful to remove it before he stepped on the scale. And it glinted from his waist, where his belt buckle was also large and solid gold. His initials seemed to be everywhere. His belt buckle was monogrammed, as were his shirts, not only on the breast pocket but on at least one cuff, and his pocket handkerchief. And when he wasn't wearing the Texas cufflinks, he was wearing links that proclaimed in solid gold LBJ from each wrist. And the shirts he preferred weren't white. He often wore shirts and ties which were both cut from the same bolt of checked or polka-dotted cloth. And the suits he preferred weren't blue. When he wore one of his favorite outfits, of which every element, trousers, vest, jacket, tie, was a monochromatic pale brown, Lyndon Johnson was, one journalist recalls, a mountain of tan. Beyond all this, the suits were outsize. Wanting them to conceal his weight, a disproportionate amount of which was in his stomach, he would shortly begin wearing a girdle in an attempt to conceal what was sometimes an enormous paunch. He had them cut extremely full and long, with wide lapels, and there was, therefore, a lot of that rich, glossy fabric on display. So generous was the cut that even when his weight was at its upper limits, not the 240 of his presidential years, but about 220 or 225, the unbuttoned jackets of his suits flared out around his hips when he walked fast or whirled around, and when he was thinner, his jackets not only flared open but flapped around him. And his trousers were cut extremely long and full, to the despair of his tailor, who complained that Johnson always looked as if he was stepping on the cuffs, and they flapped around his ankles as he rushed down a corridor or up a flight of stairs. Even when he wore a fedora or other conventional Eastern hat, it was usually tilted all the way back on his head, in the casual manner of the Southwest, and he often wore a big, gray, broad-brimmed Texas Stetson instead. And while he might be wearing black shoes, at other times he wore cowboy boots, richly embroidered and polished to a high gloss. You could see him bend down a dozen times a day to buff them up with a handkerchief, a colleague recalls. Hurrying down the crowded corridors of the House Office Building, and he seemed always to be hurrying, always to be rushing, rudely elbowing people, he had seemed, with his Texas stride and his Texas boots and his Texas hat and his Texas tie, very much the representative of the great raw province in the Southwest, swaggering through the halls of state. How would he fit in at the Senate Office Building? And he seemed even bigger than he was, for reasons that went deeper than the physical. He could dominate a room with his charm. In his circle of young New Dealers in Washington, he was the life of every party with his practical jokes, his quick wit, his wonderful Texas stories about the hellfire preachers and tough old sheriffs of the Hill Country, his vivid imitations of Washington figures, and his exuberance. Jumping up on a table in a Spanish restaurant, he pulled little Welly Hopkins up with him to dance a flamenco. At parties he was fun, Elizabeth Rowe says. That's what no one understands about Lyndon Johnson, that he was fun. Said Abe Fortas, there was never a dull moment around him. The moment he walked in the door, a party would take fire. Maybe in a different way than the party had been going when he came in, but it would take fire. And he wanted to dominate every room he was in. If he couldn't lead, he didn't want to play, wouldn't play. That had been true in Johnson City, the isolated, impoverished little huddle of houses deep in the hill country vastnesses, where as a teenager who owned the only regulation baseball in town, he had brought a saying to life. Lyndon was a terrible pitcher, one Johnson City boy remembers, but if we didn't let him pitch, he'd take his ball and go home. It had been true at the Georgetown parties at which he would go to sleep at the dinner table. He had to win every argument. Just had to. That was what had been said about him by the Johnson City boys and girls among whom he had grown up. That was what had been said about him by his college classmates. That was what had been said about him by his colleagues in the House of Representatives. And in every setting, his demeanor and disputation had been the same. One of those Johnson City companions was to recall about young Lyndon that If he'd differ with you, he'd hover right up against you, breathing right in your face, arguing your point. I got disgusted with him. Sometimes I'd try to walk away, but he just wouldn't stop until you gave in. And, of course, in the House of Representatives, as in the legislature in Austin, which he visited with his father, he had clutched you like his daddy did when he talked to you. Imbuing his arguments with special force was a theory that he held very strongly. According to his brother, had held ever since, as a boy, he had heard a salesman say, one day in the Johnson City barber shop, "You've got to believe in what you're selling." The remark made such an impression on Lyndon that during his boyhood, Sam Houston Johnson says, he was always repeating that. Decades later, in retirement at his ranch near Johnson City, Lyndon Johnson would still be repeating it, in expanded form, telling Doris Kearns Goodwin, "What convinces is conviction. You simply have to believe in the argument you are advancing. If you don't, you're as good as dead. The other person will sense that something isn't there, and no chain of reasoning, no matter how logical or elegant or brilliant, will win your case for you." He made himself believe in his arguments, believe with absolute conviction, through a process that was characteristically intense. Having observed the process repeatedly, long-time associates had been so impressed with it that they coined phrases to describe it. The revving up, they called it, or the working up. Ed Clark, who had known Johnson since his NYA days, and who for almost 20 years would be his principal attorney and principal operative in Texas, would say that he, Johnson, was an emotional man, and he could start talking about something and convince himself it was right, and get all worked up and emotional, and work all day and all night, and sacrifice, and say, "Follow me for the cause. Let's do this because it's right." The process was all-consuming. In describing Lyndon Johnson talking about a cause in which he believed, his Washington and Texas circles use words like vibrancy, intensity, energy, passion, and spellbinding. It was not just the big body, but the passions and emotions boiling up within it that made him seem so big. "He was big, all right," says one acquaintance, "but he got bigger as he talked to you." Using his own phrase to describe the process, Johnson would tell his young assistants that in order to carry a point, it was necessary to fill yourself up with the arguments in its favor. "You just have to get full of your subject and let it fly," he was to say. And he accomplished this so thoroughly that he filled himself to overflowing, as if the body, big as it was, could not contain the emotions, and they blazed out of his eyes, made one of his arms grab his listener's lapel to hold the man close while he tried to persuade him, made a four-finger jab into the man's chest, made his face push into his auditor's, forcing the other man's head back as if to physically insert the arguments into it, getting closer also to better ascertain if the arguments were working. "I want to see 'em, feel 'em, smell 'em," he said. He wanted his hands on them as he spoke to them. This was not a style of discourse which had endeared itself to colleagues in the House of Representatives, and it hardly seemed likely to do so with the new colleagues he was going to have now. The physicality of Lyndon Johnson extended into areas besides that of argument. During the 1940s, Capitol Hill was, of course, very much a man's world, in which locker-room humor and morals were common. Besides, almost half the members of the House, having been raised on farms, were accustomed to earthiness. But even some of these men were startled at Lyndon Johnson's earthiness. "He would piss in the parking lot of the House office building," says Wingate Lucas, a farm boy who represented Fort Worth. "Well, a lot of fellows did that. I did it. But the rest of us would try to hide behind a car or something. Lyndon wouldn't. He just didn't care if someone noticed him." In fact, Lucas says he seemed to want to be noticed. "I remember once we were walking across the lot and some female secretaries were behind us, and he just stopped and began to take a piss right in front of them." He would also urinate in front of his own secretaries, and since some of them were attractive young women, this too was startling to those who witnessed it. During the years in the House, he had a one-room hideaway office on the top floor of the House office building. Without a toilet, but with a wash basin in the corner of the room, concealed behind a wood and green burlap screen. While entertaining guests in the hideaway or dictating to a secretary, he would pull the screen aside and urinate in the basin. Sometimes he would put the screen back before he did so, and sometimes he wouldn't. He had always displayed great pride in his sexual apparatus. Even at college, where sexual boastfulness is a staple of campus existence, Lyndon Johnson's boastfulness and exhibitionism about his sexual prowess had been striking to his fellows. Exhibiting his penis to his roommates, Johnson called it Jumbo. Returning to his room after a date, he would say, "Jumbo had a real workout tonight," while relating physical details of the evening, including details of his companion's most intimate anatomy. And if he was urinating in a bathroom of the house office building and a colleague came in, Johnson, finishing, would sometimes turn to him with his penis in his hand. Without putting it back in his pants, he would begin a conversation, still holding it, and shaking it as if he was showing off, says one man with whom he did this. He asked another man, "Have you ever seen anything as big as this?" None of the body parts customarily referred to as private were private when the parts were Lyndon Johnson's. Nervous and restless, he couldn't seem in public to stop moving, and among the movements was an inordinate amount of scratching. Of his chest, of his stomach, and of areas not generally scratched in public. He was constantly pulling his trousers lower, either in front or back, while complaining about his tailor's failure to provide him with sufficient ballroom, and he was continually, openly, and at length scratching his rear end, quite deeply into his rear end sometimes. He would plunge a hand into a side pocket of his trousers and scratch his groin. "Crude," says Representative Richard Bowling of Missouri. "Crude, barnyard, always scratching his crotch and picking his nose in mixed company. I'll never forget, one time he had some injury, hernia or something, and even with the girls present in his office he pulled his pants down to show it. And he'd sit at his desk, and it wouldn't matter if there was a woman there. He'd pull up his scrotum while talking. We men used to be a bit embarrassed." There was, in fact, a purpose to at least some of his crudeness. Years before, while he was still only an assistant to a congressman, Lyndon Johnson himself had had two assistants, two teenage young men who had been his students when he was a high school teacher back in Texas. One, Gene Latimer, gave Johnson the unquestioning deference Johnson wanted. He would work for him for 35 years as his slave, his totally willing slave. The other, Luther E. Jones, would not. Ambitious and independent, he was afraid that you lose your individuality if you allow someone to be too demanding for too long. And if he disagreed with Johnson about something, he would voice his disagreement. Jones, a neat young man who was invariably well scrubbed, with his hair carefully slicked down, was reserved, almost prim in physical matters. Any kind of coarseness or crudeness just disgusted him, a friend says. Johnson began summoning Jones to take dictation from him while he was sitting on the toilet. At first, Latimer says, Ellie attempted to stand away from the door, but Johnson insisted he stand right over him. Ellie would stand with his head averted and take dictation. As both Latimer and Jones understood, the tactic was a method of control, employed to humiliate Jones and make him acknowledge who was boss. Years later, Richard Goodwin, a speechwriter who had just begun working for Johnson, was summoned to the president's bathroom in the White House. Watching Johnson, apparently in the midst of defecation, staring at him intently, looking for any sign of embarrassment, and lowering his tone, forcing me to approach more closely while calculating my reaction, Goodwin realized that he was being given a kind of test. Goodwin passed, and so had many of the staff members to whom Johnson had given the same test during his years in the House of Representatives. For other aspects of Lyndon Johnson's personal style as well, adjectives like restrained or dignified seemed inappropriate. Among his chronic health problems were a severe eczema-like rash on his hands and a bronchial condition, and the prescribed remedies were employed with a notable openness. He often kept a large bowl of a purple-colored salve called Lubriderm on his desk, and would, even with visitors present, plunge his hands into the bowl and assiduously rub gobs of ointment into his hands. To combat the nasal congestion produced by the bronchitis, doctors had recommended the use of a nasal inhaler, and the use was frequent, not only in his house office, but even on the house floor. Throwing his head all the way back, he would stick the inhaler into one nostril and inhale, with a slurping sound so loud it could be heard clearly in the press gallery above. Few settings seemed less appropriate for such behavior than the Senate office building or the Senate chamber. The place to which Lyndon Johnson had come seemed peculiarly unsuited to him, in addition, for reasons more serious than personal style. Because it was ruled by seniority, Ability couldn't move him along the long tables in the committee rooms toward those gavels at the end that conferred power in the Senate. Energy couldn't move him along. Only the passage of time could do that. There was, it was universally agreed, only one way to become one of the Senate's rulers: to wait. Lyndon Johnson had already had a lesson, a terribly harsh lesson, in how long seniority might make him wait. Upon his arrival in the House of Representatives in 1937, he had been assigned to its Naval Affairs Committee, whose chairman was Carl Vinson, the Georgia Swamp Fox, then in his 23rd year in Congress, but still only 53 years old, and as a Southern Democrat virtually guaranteed his seat as long as he wanted it. And of course even Vinson's death or retirement would not make Johnson chairman. Some of the committee's Democrats who sat between him and Vinson would lose their seats, some would die, some would become senators, but some would remain on the committee. He would have to survive the chairmanships of these remaining Democrats, the chairmanships laid end to end, before he could become chairman. That prospect was bleak enough, but then, in 1946, Johnson had received a brutal reminder that, because so many years were involved, no one could predict what might happen, so that even waiting was no guarantee. In that year, an unusual concatenation of deaths and defeats among the Democrats on naval affairs had left him as the committee's third-ranking Democrat. Only a single member of his party sat between him and Vinson. The chairmanship had begun to seem within his reach. Only, of course, because Johnson could not foresee Vinson's longevity. The Swamp Fox would not retire until 1965, at the age of 81. Had Johnson remained on the House Naval Affairs Committee, he would actually have had to wait 28 years before he became chairman. But it was in 1946 that the House adopted the recommendations of a bipartisan joint committee on the reorganization of Congress. And one of those recommendations was for merging the Naval Affairs and Military Affairs Committees into a single new House Armed Services Committee. 6 Democratic members of Military Affairs possessed greater seniority in the House than he did. His old committee had suddenly disappeared. On his new one, he was not the third-ranking Democrat, but the 9th. Nor was that the end of the lesson. In November 1946, the GOP won control of the House, a vivid reminder of the fact that even outwaiting or outliving all the Democrats ahead of him would not make him chairman if, when his turn in the Democratic line finally arrived, the Democrats were not the body's majority party. Lyndon Johnson had fought and twisted in the House to try to break free of the seniority trap. When the traditional Texas seat on the powerful Appropriations Committee became vacant, he planted newspaper stories hinting that President Roosevelt wanted him to have it, and half persuaded Speaker Rayburn that if no one else demanded it, he could have it. But someone else did demand it, Texas Congressman George Mahone, who had more seniority. Rayburn followed the rules, Mahone was to recall, regardless of the Speaker's fondness for Johnson. If you were in line for it, you got it. That was the way the unvarying rule was. In an attempt to help Johnson advance outside the traditional House structure, near the end of World War II, Rayburn appointed him to 2 prestigious new select post-war planning committees, whose other members were senior members of the House. But Johnson's attempt to take a leading role on the select committees earned him the senior's displeasure, and the attempt was abandoned. Rayburn himself had, long before, learned the lesson the hard way. His patron, John Nance Cactus Jack Garner, had said, "The only way to get anywhere in Congress is to stay there and let seniority take its course." Rayburn had not wanted to believe that, but as the years passed, he had realized he had no choice. He had come to Congress in 1912 at the age of 30. He did not get his first real power, the chairmanship of the House Interstate Commerce Committee, until 1931, when he was 49. He would eventually become Speaker, all right, but not until 1940, when he was 58. Lyndon Johnson had studied Rayburn's career and had known it wouldn't do for him. Too slow, too slow. The House had been too slow for Lyndon Johnson. What would the Senate be? And the Senate was ruled by the South, by that mighty Southern caucus, whose unity, that oneness found nowhere else in politics, was rooted in its members' allegiance to a cause almost holy to them. Rising to power in the Senate, to a position within the Senate from which a senator could run for president, depended on the support of Southern senators, support which would be forthcoming only after they had been thoroughly convinced that their colleagues' allegiance to that cause was firm. But that allegiance, essential for success within the Senate, would be fatal to success beyond it. would be fatal in pursuing the goal of which Lyndon Johnson had so long dreamed. There were only 11 southern states, and in many of the other 37, sympathy for that lost cause was not a recommendation. In the 8 most populous states, all of which were in the north or the west, it was, in fact, a taint. In the Senate, these 8 states cast only 16 of 96 votes, but in a presidential election, they accounted for more than 40% of the electoral vote. No Democrat could win without us, Illinois' Paul Douglas was to say. No Democrat could become president without the North's support, support not available to an advocate of segregation. It was, therefore, an article of faith in Washington that no Southerner could ever become president of the United States. This belief was stated over and over, without qualification, since no qualification was thought necessary, in conversation, and in articles and columns and editorials. When Lyndon Johnson rode in Speaker Rayburn's chauffeured limousine, staring at him was a plaque that the Speaker's Democratic colleagues had had affixed to the back of the front seat. To our beloved Sam Rayburn, who would have been president if he had come from any place but the South. Lyndon Johnson was from Texas, one of the 11 states of the Confederacy. The taint of the South was on him. For him to realize his great ambition, that taint would have to be removed. But he could rise to a position from which he could run for president only with the South's enthusiastic, unqualified support. He had trod a very rocky, narrow path to power before. Was this path, the Senate path, to prove too rocky and narrow, even for him? In addition, he had a problem with his staff, an old problem. Working for Lyndon Johnson was, in a way, very exciting, for he filled his office with a sense of drama and a sense of fun. Horace Busby had received a full dose of both on the day in 1948 on which he arrived there. A short, curly-haired young man whose editorials in the University of Texas student newspaper had caught Johnson's eye, and who had been brought to Washington a few days after his 24th birthday to be the congressman's idea man and speechwriter. Busby idolized Franklin Roosevelt, and Johnson had been told that, and when the young man was shown into Johnson's office to meet him, there, sitting behind the desk, was Franklin Roosevelt, complete to pince-nez glasses, long cigarette holder, and up-tilted, out-thrust jaw. "Come in, young man, come in," the figure behind the desk said in a perfect imitation of Roosevelt's patrician voice, and wheeling his big swivel chair around the desk, since, of course, he was paralyzed and couldn't walk, he took the astonished young man's hand and said graciously, "Sit down, sit down." Then, with obvious difficulty, he wheeled himself slowly and painfully back behind the desk and looked Busby directly in the eye. The big jaw thrust even farther out and up. "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," Franklin Roosevelt said. There followed one of Roosevelt's fireside chats, about 10 minutes of it, in Busby's recollection. I looked it up later, and it was practically word for word. And that was the end of the drama, and time for the joke. Summoning his assistant Walter Jenkins, Johnson reverted to his role as congressman, and, in his own voice, began a serious discussion with him, in the midst of which the cigarette, without warning, suddenly flew out of the holder and, sailing across the desk, landed smack in an ashtray right in front of the astonished Busby. Johnson's cigarette holder, he would learn, was equipped with a spring that ejected cigarettes, and Johnson could aim it with accuracy, thanks to hours of practice. There had been many such scenes in Lyndon Johnson's suite in the House office building, for, says his chief aide, John Connolly, Johnson created his own theater, staging real-life dramas which he claimed to have witnessed, using members of the staff in supporting roles. A favorite was the scene in Sam Rayburn's Capitol hideaway the day Roosevelt died, and the White House had telephoned to summon Vice President Truman, who was having a drink in the hideaway, to take the oath. Johnson acted the whole thing out, Busby would recall. He placed the chairs. This is how close to Truman I was. He played Rayburn and Truman. He moved over to where Rayburn would have been sitting and put on Rayburn's grim scowl. "Harry, the White House is on the line." Then he showed us Truman walking banty style across the room and spoke with thin lips hardly moving, as Truman sometimes spoke. "They want me at the White House, Sam." Then Johnson played himself for a moment. Not knowing what had happened, he said, he started to ask Rayburn a question and told Busby to give Rayburn's response. "Say, 'No, no, Lyndon, not now.' So Busby said, 'No, no, Lyndon, not now,' trying to scowl grimly as he did so. It detracted nothing from the drama in Busby's eyes when he later learned that, despite what Johnson said, he had not, in fact, been present at this historic occasion, but had only heard about it later from other men who had been. Johnson inspired his staff, too, giving each of them whatever would inspire him and cement his allegiance, making some of them, who wanted to make their mark on the world, to be a part of history, feel that if they stuck with him, they would be. As one put it, you felt that the world was moving, and Lyndon was going to be one of the movers, and if you worked for him, you'd be one of the movers. Making others, who wanted less to make a mark than to advance in life, believe that sticking with him was the way to do that, too. As J.J. Jake Pickle, one of his men in Texas, put it, that Mr. Johnson had the prospects of being a national figure, and he'd take you along with him. It was the best way to get ahead. But drama and fun and inspiration weren't all he filled his office with. Entering his office in the morning, he would stride from desk to desk. If an assistant's desk was cluttered with papers, he might say, with a snarl in his voice, "Clean up your fucking desk." If an assistant's desk was clean, he might say, with a snarl in his voice, "I hope your mind isn't as empty as that desk." Moving from desk to desk, he would pick up or yank out of a typewriter whatever paper an aide was working on, and, one says, look to see if anything was wrong with it. And God help you if he found something. Jesus, he could rip a man up and down. "God, you're stupid," he would yell at one assistant. "You couldn't find your ass if you were using both hands." To another, he would shout, "You couldn't pour piss out of a boot if the instructions were printed on the heel." Or a letter might remind him of a phone call he had been intending to make. He would reach out and grab the nearest phone, even if at that moment a secretary was talking to someone on it. Ripping the phone out of her hands as she was in the middle of a sentence, he would cut off the call and dial the number he wanted. As for incoming calls, they had to be answered on the first ring, or else. If you were on the phone with someone and someone else called, you had to put that first person on hold immediately so you could pick up the second person on the first ring, says Ashton Ganella, who would come to work for Johnson several years later. After several tongue-lashings when she violated that rule, Ms. Ganella devised the strategy of keeping her phone off the hook so that when it rang she could answer it by simply pressing the button that lit up on her six-line telephone console. Opening the top drawer of Jenkins's desk, Johnson would take out the sheet Jenkins had to fill out each evening, showing how many constituent letters each member of the staff had answered the previous day. The daily quota was 100 letters per person. If a box on the sheet contained the number 55, he would shout, "That's 45 good Texans who didn't get the service they deserved yesterday." And that was only the first shout. His rages were terrible, says Congressman Richard Bowling, who witnessed some. I mean almost literally. If he'd had a whip in his hand, I'm sure he would have given them a couple of lashes with it. Once, Gene Latimer felt it would make sense to draw a large map of Texas, with each of the state's 254 counties and the name of its county chairman, and pin it up in the office so that his fellow aides could see which chairman to notify about a constituent's problem. Because it took all day for him to do that, however, the next morning the box by the name Latimer had a zero in it. Johnson turned that stare, that terrible stare, on the little man who adored him so and was so psychologically dependent on him. When Latimer explained what he had done, Lyndon Johnson asked, "I don't pay you to make maps, do I?" Latimer said he didn't. "The next time you do something like that, I'll rip the fucking thing right off the wall," Johnson said. On another occasion, when he had buzzed out from his inner office for a scotch, a secretary made a mistake and poured sherry instead. Yelling, "You've poisoned me!" Johnson hurled the glass against a wall so hard that it shattered. And then he sat at his desk, not saying a word, just staring at the secretary, through the long minutes during which, using paper towels from the bathroom, she knelt on the floor, blotting up the sherry and picking up the pieces of glass. On another occasion, when, as Nellie Brill Connolly, John's wife, who worked for Johnson for 4 years, recalls, "I didn't get a telephone number fast enough for Mr. Johnson. He threw a book at me. I was a little afraid of him after that." The general abuse he would direct at offenders was, aides say, not so bad, no matter how loud it was shouted at you in front of your fellow workers, not compared to the personal remarks Lyndon Johnson made, for he possessed not only a lash for a tongue, but a talent for using it to find a victim's most sensitive spot. When he would buzz for coffee, it had to be hot, recalls one secretary, who was recently divorced and very sensitive about that fact. One morning it wasn't hot enough. "No wonder you couldn't keep your husband," Johnson said to her. "You can't even make coffee." He insisted on ordering every aspect of his staff members' lives, the way they dressed, down to the knots in his men's neckties, or his women's weight, hairdo, and makeup. "Well, I see we're putting on a few pounds, aren't we?" he would say to his secretary. "Which meant that you'd better go on a diet," says Yolanda Boozer, one of his secretaries. Or if you hadn't had your hair done, he would come into the office and say, "Well, it's getting a little windy out there, isn't it?" If such hints did not produce the desired result, he would be more direct. To one secretary, with whose appearance he was still dissatisfied, he said, "Why don't you put on some lipstick, and then I'd like you to send a letter." He was adamant about your not having a run in your stocking. He could see it a mile away. I'd be so nervous every time I'd start to walk away from him. I knew I would get the complete up-and-down look. I mean scrutiny. And if you had even a little bit of a run, you'd better change those stockings. It was best always to have an extra pair in your drawer. He explained his concern about weight to Busby, telling him, "I don't see the front of my secretaries. I don't see them until they put something down on my desk and are walking away. I don't want to look at an Aunt Minnie. I want to look at a good, trim back end." And Ashton Ganella understood his insistence on other aspects of appearance. Everybody had to be perfect, so appearance was all important to him. When I came to work for him, I had long hair, which was the style at the time. One morning he said, "You're going to the beauty shop today, and you're going to have 10 pounds cut off that." The members of his staff knew that they would have to work in the Senate office building the same hours they had worked in the House office building, hours which had astonished people who learned about them. All members of that staff worked 6 days a week, and sometimes seven. The men who handled the mail had to work alternate Sundays. And these were very long days. Some of the staff, those who unloaded the mail each morning from the big gray mail bags, had to be waiting at the office when the bags arrived at 7 o'clock. Others started the day at either 8 or 8:30. And no matter when they started in the morning, they usually had to work into the evening, sometimes quite late into the evening. Nadine Brammer, who would come to work for him in 1955, wrote a friend that she arrived early in the morning, "and sometimes I don't see daylight again until the next morning. Usually we have a sandwich at our desks for lunch, and it's dark most evenings when we leave." Nor did the workday end when they went home. If Johnson had a thought during the night that he wanted to communicate to a member of his staff, he simply picked up the telephone and called him or her at home, no matter what the hour. "There wasn't even a hello or a 'This is Congressman Johnson,' one says. You were woken up at 2 or 3 a.m., and there was a voice in your ear giving an order." The men on the staff were worked to exhaustion. One congressman was having a drink with Lyndon Johnson late one evening in his House hideaway office, and Johnson buzzed for Walter Jenkins. The door opened, and there was this guy, shirt rumpled, tie askew, face pale, standing in the door holding a yellow legal pad, waiting for orders, like a slave.
End of Disc 6.